Bleak House by Charles Dickens. Dramatized in 8 episodes by Betty Davis. With Michael Bryant, Sarah Kestelman, Robert Lang, and Brenda Blethyn as Esther Summerson. Part 2, The Law Writer.
We lived at first rather a busy life at Bleak House, for we had to become acquainted with many residents in the neighborhood who knew Mr. Jarndyce. It amazed us when we began to sort out his letters to find how the great object of nearly all his correspondence appeared to be to form themselves into committees for getting in money and then laying it out on a great variety of worthy and unworthy causes. One of those most distinguished for her rapacious benevolence, if I may use the expression, was a Mrs. Pardigal, a formidable style of lady with spectacles, a prominent nose and a loud voice, who had the effect of wanting a great deal of room.
So, Mr. Jarndyce is out. How very unfortunate. I know he'd be anxious to contribute to the superannuated widow's relief fund.
You could wait a little while, Mrs. Pardigal.
I can do no such thing, Miss Summerson. I am on my way now to visit a brickmaker in this neighborhood, a very bad character. Indeed, I hope you'd be willing to accompany me on my rounds, and Miss Clare, too.
Oh, but we have no experience. We aren't qualified. We'd be of little assistance to you.
None at all, I'm sure. But it might profit you both to see how I go about it. Perhaps, however, you are not equal to hard work.
That wasn't what I meant.
Very well, then. I'll be glad to take you both with me. Come. Well, my friends, I'm here again.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, come on then. I want it over and done with. I'm tired of these liberties took with my place.
There, my little one.
Now, I want you to explain to these two young ladies.
Are you going to poll pry and question me again? Because if you are, I'll save you the trouble. How have I been conducting myself? Why, I've been drunk for 3 days, and I'd have been drunk before if I had the money. And how did my wife get that black eye? Why, I gave it to her. If she says I didn't, she's a lie.
My good man, I am not to be deterred. I enjoy hard work, and the harder you make it for me, the better I like it.
Then I'll make it easy for you. Get on with what you have to say. Go.
I shall read you a passage from Isaiah chapter 1, and I trust that you will benefit from it. Wash you, make you clean. Put away the evil of your doings from before mine eyes. Cease to do evil. And the strong shall be as tow, and the maker of it as a spark. And they shall both burn together, and none shall quench them.
You've done, have you?
What a day I have, my friend. But I am never fatigued. I shall come to you again in your regular order. Come, young ladies.
We'll follow you.
Forgive me, but is your baby ill?
He's very poorly, miss.
May we see him?
Poor little thing.
Why, he's so cold.
Ada, come away. Don't you see? The baby is...
Oh, no! Oh, the little thing. How pitiful. Oh, baby.
He's gone, hasn't he? My baby's dead.
Jenny? Is this true? I see it is.
Our Lord has taken him to join the innocents in heaven.
I'm so sorry for you. Poor little baby.
5 we had. All dead now. So much the better for him and the better for us too.
We stayed a little while and did what we could for them. I took the little body from the mother and tried to make the baby's rest prettier and gentler. I laid him down on a shelf, he was so light in my arms, and covered the little face with my handkerchief. How little I thought then on whose unquiet bosom that handkerchief would come to lie. We said as little as we could to Mr. Jarndyce, but the wind changed to the east directly.
Excellent people, Mrs. Pardigal and the rest. Oh, do a great deal of good. But they will knock in tacks with sledgehammers. They make such a bustle and noise and are so confoundedly indefatigable. Oh, law, yes, I feel the wind all over me.
I'll come there with you tomorrow, Esther. I've made some money today. I can give the family £5.
£5, Richard?
Rick, how have you made £5? Have you forgotten, Cousin John? You gave me 10 because you found out how much I'd lent to Harold Skimpole. So I've made £10 clear.
Rick, you have not. You've had your own money back.
At any rate, I've got £10 more than I expected to have, so I can afford to spend it.
No, you cannot afford it. I applaud your generous intentions, but leave the brickmaker and his family to me. I promise you, I'll do all I can.
Oh, well, if you forbid it, then...
Forbid is too harsh a word, Rick.
If you prefer me not to, of course, I won't. But then...
Yes?
Then I think I'll go out to London for a day. A good rattle there and back in a postchaise. Put it down as £4, and I've just saved £5 out of the brickmaker's affair.
Rick, Rick, Cody, we must attend to your financial education, I see. But never mind that for the moment. I must ask you not to go to London just now.
Oh,
I'm expecting a friend here, and I want you all to meet him.
Another visitor? Is he at all like Harold Skimpole?
Oh, he's not in the least like Harold Skimpole. His name is Lawrence Boythorn, and I was at school with him, 45 years ago. Oh, he's a tremendous fellow.
In stature, sir?
Oh, in stature? Yes. He's 10 years older than me and 2 inches taller. When we were at school, he took me under his protection and knocked out 2 of the school bully's teeth because he was tormenting me. But, you know, when I said he was a tremendous fellow, I was talking about the great heart of the man. When you see him with his head thrown back like an old soldier and his chest squared, and when you hear him, oh, dear me, when you hear him talking, laughing, or snoring, he shakes the house to the rafters.
I remember that boy well, Jarndyce. Knocking out his teeth did his countenance no harm. For upon this whole, his face was the blackest image of perfidy, cowardice, and cruelty ever set up as a scarecrow in a field of scoundrels. Ah, that was a good 45 years ago. Time rushes by us now, eh, Jarndyce? And speaking of time, how goes the great case?
Oh, it goes nowhere, Boythorn, as ever it stands still.
On my honour, if I were in your place, I'd seize every master in Chancery by the throat and shake him till his money rolled out of his pocket and his bones rattled in his skin. Ah, by heaven, I'd have a settlement of your case out of somebody by fair means or foul. If you'd allow me, I'd do it for you tomorrow.
Well, thank you, Boythorn, but I doubt if that would advance the suit.
More wine.
Thank you, thank you. There never was such an infernal cauldron as that Chancery on the face of the earth.
But you yourself aren't free from the toils of the law. How are you getting on about that right of way?
The infernal fellows brought action against me for assault.
Oh, no. And how have you replied to that?
I've brought action against him for trespass. Sir Leicester Dedlock, indeed. Sir Lucifer would be a better name for him.
Complimentary to our distant relative, Eric.
Oh, I would beg Mr. Carston's pardon. And Miss Clare's, too, if I wasn't sure that they kept their distant relative at a comfortable distance.
Oh, he keeps us. Mr. Jarndyce wrote to Sir Leicester to solicit his assistance in my future career. But he gave us a very dusty answer. He said he'd do what he could, but he could do nothing.
My man's a stiff-necked, arrogant imbecile.
Oh.
I beg your pardon.
I've never met him, Mr. Boythorn. In any event, it's his lady to whom I'm related, and the tie is very distant.
Ah, Lady Dedlock's another matter. A most accomplished lady to whom I'd willingly do homage. But I'll have no closing of my paths by any Dedlock. Sir Leicester sent a most abandoned villain with one eye to build a gate shutting off the path. A path that runs through my land.
Yeah.
He constructed the gate during the night, and I chopped it down and burned it next day. I brought an action for trespass, and he brought an action for assault and battery, and so the matter rests. I'm waiting to hear from your fellows, Kenge and Carboy. Ah. There's nothing from them, I suppose. I told them to write to me here.
I think not. Esther?
Nothing, Guardian.
I've no need to ask. Even my slight experience has taught me how great Miss Summerson's forethought is for everyone around her. And now I'm going to put your forethought to the test, Jarndyce, and ask for some more of this excellent wine.
We all liked Mr. Boythorn. We liked his laugh and we liked his vigorous, healthy voice. With all his seeming ferocity, he was so gentle and courteous to me and to Ada that I was not surprised when my guardian told me that he'd been disappointed in love as a young man and in consequence had never married. I thought a great deal about this old love story and tried to do that very difficult thing. Imagine old people young and invested with the graces of youth. With the morning, there came a letter from Kenjan Carboy to inform Mr. Boythorn that one of their clerks would wait upon him at noon. The emissary turned out to be Mr. Guppy, but I scarcely knew him again. He was so uncommonly smart. He had on an entirely new suit of glossy clothes, a shining hat, kid gloves, and a flower in his buttonhole. The interview took a long time and seemed to be stormy, for even from downstairs I heard Mr. Boythorn's voice rising like a high wind and evidently blowing perfect broadsides of denunciation. I didn't wonder that Mr. Guppy came back looking something the worse for the conference.
My eye, Miss, he's a tart.
Would you like to take some refreshments, sir?
Thank you. And what will you take yourself, Miss?
Nothing, thank you. I only waited to see that you had everything you wanted. Can I order anything else for you?
No, no. Much obliged to Miss, I'm sure. I've everything I need to make you comfortable. At least, not comfortable. I'm never that.
Then I shall leave you to your luncheon.
I beg your pardon, Miss. Could I ask the favour of a minute's private conversation?
Yes?
What follows is without prejudice, Miss.
Well, I don't understand what you mean.
But one of our lawyer terms, Miss. If our conversation don't lead to anything, I'm to be as I was, not prejudiced in my situation or worldly prospects. In short, it's in total confidence.
Well, Mr. Guffey, I can't imagine what you have to say to me in confidence. You've only met me once. But I'd be very sorry to do you an injury.
Thank you, Miss. I'm sure of it. That's enough of an answer. You'll excuse me taking another glass of wine. I think it might assist me in getting on without a continual choke that cannot fail to be unpleasant. Oh, may I offer you some wine, Miss?
Oh, not any, thank you.
Well, not half a glass? No. Well, then, to proceed. My present salary is £2 a week. A rise of 15 shillings is guaranteed at the expiry of a term not exceeding 12 months from the present time. My mother has a small annuity upon which she lives in an independent, though unassuming manner in the Old Street Road. She's eminently calculated for a mother-in-law.
Mother-in-law?
Yes. She never interferes and is all for peace. She has her failings, but who has not? But I never noticed her to do it when company was present, at which time you may freely trust her with wine, spirits and malt liquor. My own abode is lodgings in Penton Place, Pentonville. It's lowly, but airy. It's open at the back. Considered healthy. Miss Summerson, I adore you. Would you be so kind as allow me to make you an offer?
Mr. Guppy, get up from your knees.
Now, hear me out, Miss.
I won't listen to another word while you're in that ridiculous position. Get up from the carpet at once and go and sit down at the table.
There you go. But the soul recoils from food at such a moment, Miss.
You've asked me to hear you out. Please finish what you have to say.
I will, Miss. As I love and honour, so likewise I obey. Would I could make thee the object of that vow before the shrine.
That's quite impossible, Mr. Guppy.
Well, I'm aware that from a worldly point of view my offer is a poor one, but Miss Summerson, angel...
Mr. Guppy, I shall have to ring the bell if you go on in this way.
No, don't ring. I was about to say I've been brought up in a sharp school. I've seen a lot of life, though a young man. Blessed with your hand, what means might I not find of advancing your interests and making your fortune?
What can you mean?
In my way of business, Miss, I comes across things...
I do not wish you to advance my interests, Mr. Guppy. If you've finished, I must ask you to go at once.
Now, cruel, Miss. Hear one word more. You must have seen when we first met that I was struck with your charms and could not forbear a tribute. This hour today was planned by me alone for thee alone. And if I spoke of your advancement just now, it was only to recommend myself in my respectful wretchedness. Love was before it, and is before it.
I would never want to slight any honest feeling, Mr. Guppy, however ill-timed and misplaced. I feel I ought to thank you, but I hope you'll go away now as if you had never been so exceedingly foolish and attend to Mrs. Kenjan Carboy's business.
Well, half a minute, Miss. This has been without prejudice.
I'll never mention it.
A quarter of a minute. In case you should think better of, at any time, however distant, Mr. William Guppy, Penton Place, will find me. And if removed or dead, care of Mrs. Guppy, 302 Old Street Road.
I rang the bell. The servant came, and Mr. Guppy... making a dejected bow, departed. Later, when I went to my room, I surprised myself by beginning to laugh about it. And then surprised myself still more by beginning to cry about it. In short, I was in a flutter for a little while, and felt as if an old cord had been more coarsely touched than it had ever been since the days of the dear old doll, long buried in the garden. I could not help contrasting this ridiculous episode with something that was going on before my eyes. I'd never before watched two young people falling in love, but it was very clear to me that this was happening to Richard and Ada. So I was not surprised when she said that she had something to tell me.
Great secret, Esther. You'd never guess.
I wonder what it could be.
It's about Richard.
What about Richard?
He says, I know it's foolish, we're both so young. But he says he loves me.
Does he indeed? Why, my pet, I could have told you that weeks ago.
You knew, but you never said.
I waited to be told.
But Esther, that's not the worst of it.
No, you don't mean to tell me that you...
Yes, I do. I do, with all my heart.
I knew that, too.
Oh, Esther. Oh, do you think that Cousin John knows?
Unless he's blind, Cousin John knows pretty well as much as I do.
We want to speak to him. Will you advise us when Richard comes in?
When Richard... He's outside, then, is he?
I'm not quite certain, but I think he's waiting at the door. And Esther...
Yes?
We wondered, could you speak to Cousin John first?
Rick, I'm glad I've won your confidence. I hope I'll keep it. I told Esther that when we all first met, I certainly did contemplate the possibility of you and your pretty cousin going through life together. But, that was far off.
We look afar off, sir.
Yes, that's sensible. Now listen, my dears. I might tell you that you don't know your own minds yet and that a thousand things might happen to change the way you feel.
Sir.
But let's assume that a few years hence, you'll still be all in all to each other.
We shall, Cousin John.
But if you do find that you're more commonplace cousins to each other as man and woman than you were as boy and girl, don't be ashamed to tell me. There'd be nothing uncommon or disastrous in it. Now, supposing your feelings don't change, there's still the question of your future, Rick.
Oh, yes, sir.
It may well take you away from here. The world's before you. Trust in Providence and your own efforts. No real success can be wrested from fortune by fits and starts. If you think it can, leave that wrong idea here, or leave your cousin Ada. If you are not to make her happy, why should you pursue her?
I wouldn't make her unhappy, not even for her love.
Well said. Oh, now, that's the end of my preaching. I think you and Ada had better take a walk.
Yes, sir.
The door stood open. They passed into the next room where the sun was shining, and out at its further end. So young, so beautiful, so full of hope and promise. They went on lightly through the sunlight, as their own happy thoughts might then be traversing the years to come and making them all years of brightness. So they passed into the shadow and were gone. It was only a burst of light that had been so radiant. The room darkened as they went out, and the sun was clouded over. We held many consultations about Richard's future. His first thought had been that he'd like to go to sea. But when Mr. Jarndyce suggested he might be too old to enter the Navy, he said perhaps he was. Mr. Jarndyce asked him about the Army, and he said it wasn't a bad notion, but he couldn't make up his mind. He knew he didn't want to go into the Church, and although the law seemed a capital profession, he wasn't sure it was the thing for him. Finally, and quite unexpectedly, he said he wanted to be a doctor. Mr. Kenge was asked to make the necessary arrangements.
Yes. Well, a very good profession, Mr. Jarndyce. A very good profession.
Thank you, sir. The course of study needs to be diligently pursued.
Oh, no doubt. Diligently.
But that's the case with any pursuit that's worth much.
Truly. and Mr. Richard Carstone will no doubt apply himself with diligence to the field of action upon which he now enters.
I'll go at it and do my best.
Good. Good. He will go at it and do his best. Now, with reference to placing Mr. Richard with some sufficiently eminent practitioner, is there anyone in view?
No one.
Well, we have only to find an eligible practitioner and to make clear our want. And, shall I add, our ability to pay a premium.
Oh, yes, well, of course.
It is a coincidence that I have a cousin in the medical profession. He might be deemed eligible by you and might be disposed to respond to this proposal. I can answer for him as little as for you, but he might.
Mr. Kench's cousin was a Mr. Bayham Badger, who had a good practice in Chelsea. As Mr. Boythorn had gone home to Lincolnshire, we all accompanied Richard to London, where we took rooms at a cheerful lodging near Oxford Street while he concluded his business. Mr. Badger was quite willing to receive him into his home. Harold Skimpole came to call on us one morning. He was his usual agreeable self.
Well, Jarndyce, here I am at last. I would have called on you before. But I haven't been very well.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Oh, I'm completely recovered, I assure you. I've been a little bilious. But that's a rich man's ailment, so I've been persuading myself that I must be a man of property. Well, so I am, by intention. I've been enriching my medical man quite extravagantly, in intention. I said to him, "My dear doctor, if you think you attend me for nothing, you're deluding yourself. I'm overwhelming you with money in my expansive intentions, if you only knew it."
I trust he took the point.
Well, you know, I'm not entirely sure that he did. My butcher certainly didn't.
Your butcher?
He told me he wanted his little bill. It's part of the unconscious poetry of the man's nature that he always calls it a little bill, to make the payment easier. I said to him, "My good friend, if you but knew it, you can pay it. I fully meant to pay you, and the intention is as good as the deal."
Ah, but supposing he meant the meat he supplies you instead of providing it.
Well, he took that identical position. I pointed out to him that our situations were entirely different. He had the meat, so he could not mean to send it without sending it. I, on the other hand, had not got the money. He could say not a word.
Will he take legal action?
Oh. Well, if he does, he'll be actuated by passion, not by reason. Oh, passion reminds me of Boythorn. He tells me that you and these ladies are to visit him at his bachelor house in Lincolnshire.
Mr. Boythorn was kind enough to invite us.
He's a great favourite with my girls, so I've promised them a visit.
He's a little too boisterous, a little too vehement. Oh, but I'll grant you a sledge-hammering kind of merit in him. He's invited me, too. He proposes to pay for my transport there and back again. And I suppose it will cost money. Shillings, perhaps? Or pounds? Or something of the sort. Oh, by the by, Covins's. You remember our friend Covins's in Somerton?
You mean the officer who came down
To arrest me? Yes, just so. I christened him Covins's after that house he kept referring to. He's been arrested by the great bailiff.
Oh. You mean
he's dead? Yes. He'll never do violence to the sunshine anymore. His successor told me about it. His successor is at my house now, in possession. He told me that Covins's has left 3 children. No mother. They have some disadvantage, apparently. Their father's profession being unpopular.
I don't like this, Skimpole. The man was necessary.
Do you think so, John?
The man was necessary. If we make such men necessary by our faults and follies or our lack of worldly wisdom, we mustn't revenge ourselves on them.
Oh.
He maintained his children. I'd like to know more about this.
Well, nothing easier. Walk to Covins's headquarters and you can ask what you will. It'll be a refreshing novelty for me to seek out Covins's instead of Covins's wanting me.
You can find your own way up, sir. And I'll follow slowly. Oh, the stairs try me a bit as I get older. You take the key. It's on the 3rd floor.
Thank you, Mrs. Blinder.
We're locked in. Mrs. Blinder's got the key. Who locked you in?
Charlie.
Is Charlie your brother?
No, she's my sister, Charlotte. Father called her Charlie.
Are there any more of you besides Charlie?
No, only me and Emma and Charlie.
Where's Charlie now?
Out of washing. Here she is. She comes back sometimes if she can, see how we are.
Give Emma to me, Tom. Good afternoon, sir, lady. Yes. There, Emma.
Good afternoon, Charlie. How old are you?
Over 13, sir.
Oh, what a great age.
Do you live here alone with your little brother and sister?
Yes, miss. Since father died.
And how do you live, Charlie? Oh, Charlie, how do you live?
Since father died, I've gone out to work. I've been out washing today.
My child, you're not tall enough to reach the tub.
Oh, in patterns I am, sir. I got a high pair as belonged to mother.
When did your mother die?
She died just after Emma was born.
Dear.
So father said I was to be as good a mother to them both as I could. So I tried. I did the cleaning and nursing and washing. That's how I know how. And when father died, I began to go out.
Oh, how often do you go out?
As often as I can. To earn sixpences and shillings. I lock the babies up to keep them safe. Mrs. Blinder comes up now and then, and so does Mr. Gridley. From downstairs. Don't mind being locked up, do you, Tom?
No. Oh, it's not much to be given them, is it? Who could take it from them?
Who, indeed? But you're a good woman, Mrs. Blinder. Can this little girl possibly go on doing all this?
Oh, well, yes, sir, I think she might. She's very handy.
Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. I don't come in to stare about me. Well, Tom. Oh, Charlie. How are we all?
Very well, thank you, Mr. Gridley.
Surely no one would come here to stare about them.
Maybe. I don't want to argue with ladies and gentlemen. I didn't have arguing to last me a lifetime.
You've sufficient reason, I dare say.
You know anything about courts of equity?
Oh, I do. To my sorrow.
Then I beg your pardon. I'm a standing joke of the Court of Chancery. You've heard him laugh about the man from Shropshire. Well, I am the man from Shropshire.
I know, the Court of Chancery. You may have heard my name there. Jarndyce.
Oh, Mr. Jarndyce, you bear your wrongs more quietly than I can bear mine. It's only by resenting them and regularly demanding the justice I never get that I can keep my wits together.
And what is your history?
A bitter one. Not so unusual. 30 years ago, my father died and left everything to my mother. And she died always to come to me, except a legacy of £300 to my brother. He claimed this when she died 5 years later, but I said he'd had a part of it already in board and lodging. We had to go into this accursed chancery. Long ago, the cost amounted to 3 times the legacy, and my brother would have given it all up joyfully, but he could not. Now the old estate is gone in cost, and here I stand a ruined man. Your suit involves thousands, mine hundreds, but is my lot less hard to bear?
No. I'm sorry for you with all my heart.
I'm told on all hands that it's the system. And there's no one I can blame. But by heaven, I'll blame somebody. I'll accuse the workers of that system face to face before the great eternal bar. I've done violent, I know. I've been in prison for contempt of court many times. They tell me I'd do better to go on to Shropshire, but I show myself in that court to the last, to its shame. They tell me that when I was young, I was a good-tempered man. You're not afraid of me, are you, Tom?
No, you aren't angry with me.
No, I'm not angry with you. I came to take these babies downstairs for a time. Shouldn't wonder if we found a gingerbread soldier down there, Tom. Let's go and look for him.
He bowed to us and went back to his room, taking Tom and Emma with him. We walked downstairs with Charlie. Outside, we watched her as she ran off back to work. Such a little creature in her womanly bonnet and apron. She melted into the city's strife and sound like a dewdrop in an ocean. My guardian was very silent the rest of that day. I knew that he was thinking about those children and wondering how best to help them. He opened his heart and his purse to anyone in need. He had, I knew, been very good to that other poor victim of the Court of Chancery, little Miss Blight, who had lately been ill. We decided to call on her to see how she was. We found her doctor with her, a dark young man we'd met before it had happened, at dinner with Mr. Bayham Badger and Richard. Ada had teased me by saying, But it doesn't matter what Ada said.
Honored indeed by another visit from the wards in Jarndyce.
Thank you,
I'm very happy to receive Jarndyce of Bleak House beneath my humble roof.
Oh, thank you.
My physician, Mr. Woodcourt, the wards in Jarndyce. Jarndyce of Bleak House.
And we're all acquainted with Mr. Woodcourt. Has she been very ill?
Oh, decidedly unwell. Oh, very unwell indeed. Not pain, you know. Trouble. But I'm better now. Mr. Woodcourt has been so good.
I hope I've been of some small use.
You're the kindest physician in the college. I expect a judgment on the day of judgment, and shall then confer estates.
In a day or two, she'll be as well as she'll ever be. In other words, quite well, of course. Have you heard of her good fortune?
Most extraordinary. Never heard of such a thing, my dears. Every Saturday, Mr. Guppy, clerk to Conversation Kench, places in my hand a paper of shillings. Shillings, I assure you. One for every day of the week. Now, from whom do these papers come? Shall I tell you what I think?
Please do.
I think the Lord Chancellor forwards them. Until the judgment I expect is given, I taxed him with it, and he almost confessed. Well, that is, I smiled at him in court, and he smiled at me from his bench. Is not that creditable to him?
Yes, I've heard of the kindness of the Lord Chancellor.
What do you call these little fellows, Mum? Have they any names?
Yes, they have. Miss Flight promised to tell us what they were.
I can tell you.
What do you want, Crook? I have company.
Your servant, sir, ladies. Looking at my lodger's birds, are you? She'll never tell their names if she can help it. One of her strange ways. Ain't them all she has. Shall I run them over, Flight?
If you like.
Hope, joy, youth, peace, rest, life. Dust. Ashes, waste, want, ruin, despair, madness, death, cunning, folly. Words, wigs, rags, sheepskin, plunder, president, jargon, gammon and spinach. And that's the old collection.
Oh, 'tis a bitter wind.
When my noble and learned brother gives his judgment, they're to be let go free. But if that ever happened, which it won't, the birds that have never been caged would kill them.
Ever the wind was in the east, I think it's there today.
There are quite a number of us here, and Miss Flight still tires easily. But perhaps it would be best if we were...
Of course. We only wish to assure ourselves that she was being cared for. And now we see that she's in good hands.
I call upon her every day.
No, don't go yet. Come and see the court.
The court?
How did they tell you? They call me the Lord Chancellor, and they call my shop the Court of Chancery, on account of the things I've collected that stand there gathering dust. I've got more documents than you dream of, Jarndyce of Bleak House. Documents and papers from more than 50 years ago.
Crook, you become tedious. I am a little tired. Vastly improved, I assure you, but... A little tired.
We'll leave you to your rest, Miss Flight. Very well, Mr. Crook. I prefer your Court of Chancery to the real thing. Lead the way.
What is this room? It isn't part of your shop, is it?
I see nothing for sale.
No, the shop's downstairs. This is my study.
Your study? What do you do here?
I teach myself to read and write.
And how do you get on?
So bad, it's hard at my time of life.
It'll be easier to be taught by someone.
Aye. But they might teach me wrong.
Why do you suppose that?
I don't know. Mr. Jarndyce of Bleak House. But I'd rather trust myself than any other. Hi, Lady Jane, where are you? It's in some mischief, eh?
Is he deranged, Mr. Woodcourt?
No, I think not. Ignorant and suspicious, certainly.
And he drinks a great deal of raw gin, I'm afraid. Oh, but he isn't mad.
He's gone out on the roof now. Come, the Court of Chancery is downstairs, back in the shop. He's in there, behind that door.
He?
My other lodger. I never sees him. He stops there, shut in the dark.
How strange.
Miss Summerson, are you unwell?
Why, Esther, what's the matter? You've gone so pale. For a moment, I felt something.
Something?
I felt cold.
A moment's faintness, perhaps. Your colour's coming back now.
Yes. Yes, that's all it was. See, I have cried myself again now.
Take my arm. We can't have you fainting in the Court of Chancery.
No, indeed.
So Esther descends the stairs on Alan Woodcourt's arm. And the further she draws away from that dark door, the more the colour returns to her cheek. The door stays shut. All through the day until the faint sunshine fades outside and the world becomes as dark as the law writer's room. Nothing stirs within. Not a movement, not a word, not a sound. Until the sun has set, when old Mr. Tulkinghorn comes silently up the stairs and stands on that same landing, knocking at the shadowed door.
Hello, my friend. Hello.
A small room, black with soot and grease and dirt. The floor is bare and there is no curtain, but the discolored shutters are drawn together. Through two great holes pierced in them, famine might be staring in, the banshee of the man on the bed.
Who's that?
It's me, Crook. Can't you wake him?
No. Does he generally sleep like this?
I don't know. Keeps himself very close.
God save us. He's dead.
Dead?
A doctor. We must send for some doctor.
Ask Miss Flight. She knows a doctor. Mr. Woodcourt. He visits her every day.
Miss Flight?
My other lodger upstairs. You go on up, sir. I'll stay with him.
Cover his face. This sheet is filthy, but it'll have to serve. It's only a few hours since I passed this door. If only...
When did he die, then?
About 3 hours ago, I'd guess.
How did he die?
From an overdose of opium. The room reeks of it. Has he any relatives?
Oh, not that I know. He told me once that I was the nearest relative he had. Do you think he did it on purpose?
I can't tell. He was very poor, I suppose.
I suppose he was. His room don't look rich. I've never been in it since he come here.
Did he owe you any rent?
6 weeks.
He'll never pay it. I should think his death was a happy release. Yet he must have been a good figure when he was young. And I dare say good looking. There's something... Would you say he'd had a fall in life?
Can't say. He was my lodger for a year and a half. I know nothing about him.
Did you find him like this?
I didn't find him. The gentleman who called you found him.
I looked in here to offer him employment. He was a law writer. I heard about him from my stationer, Snagsby of Cook's Court. Perhaps it would be as well to send for him.
If someone was to say to me, Snagsby, he has £20,000, if you give us information about that man, I couldn't do it, sir. He came to me when he moved in here with Mr. Crook and asked for work. Mm. I tried him out and found he had a quick hand and didn't mind night work. He called himself Nemo. That's all I know.
Nemo? Nemo is Latin for no one. You'd better see if there are any papers that can tell us anything. That old portmanteau. Crook?
Yeah?
Can you read?
No, that I can't.
Well then, Snagsby, you and I had better look through this room and see if we can find out. It won't take long.
But there is nothing. Some worthless articles of clothing, a bundle of pawnbroker's tickets, and a crumpled paper smelling of opium. That is all. Nothing to tell them who Nemo was. No sign of a relative, no sign of a friend. Nothing at the inquest, either. Nobody knew him. Nobody spoke to him, it seems, until a neighbor remembers that they've seen him talking to the boy that sweeps the crossing in the lane. The boy is sent for. He is very muddy, very hoarse, very ragged, and mightily afraid.
What is your name, boy?
Joe.
Joe? Is that all?
Nothing else that I knows of.
But everyone has two names, didn't you know that?
Never heard of such a thing.
Is Joe short for a longer name?
Don't know.
How do you spell it?
Spell?
Can't you read, boy? Haven't you been to school?
No, never.
Where is your home?
What's home?
Now, Joe, before you give your evidence, I must ask you if you know that you must not tell a lie.
I know that it's wicked to tell lies. I'll tell the truth.
You know what will happen to you if you don't tell the truth.
Don't know. Something bad, I suppose.
This won't do, gentlemen. This boy's evidence can't be recorded. Put aside this witness. Call the next witness.
Accidental death, Mr. Tulkinghorn.
Only possible, then. One moment. I must talk to that boy.
Come here.
May.
Yes, yes.
Now, boy, I want you to tell me, and Mr. Snagsby here, all you knew about this man is Nemo.
Didn't know much. He's very good to me, he was.
Good to you? How?
Well, if he had money, he'd give me some. And if he didn't, he'd say to me, I'm as poor as you today, Joe. He said he was like me. He hadn't a friend in the world.
And what else did he say?
Asked if I slept sound at night and if I ever wanted to die. Funny things like that. But he was very good to me, he was. Uh-huh. And as I see him laying so stretched out just now, I wish he could have heard me tell him so.
Here, Joe. If you ever see me with my little woman, with Mrs. Snagsby, don't mention this half crown.
Joe shuffles down the stairs of the Sol's Arms, where the inquest has been held. The proceedings are quite at an end. So, the man who called himself Nobody, whom nobody knew except Joe, is borne off to a pestiferous churchyard, a beastly scrap of ground with houses on every side save where a reeking little court gives access to an iron gate. There, they lower our dear brother, here departed, down a foot or two. Here, sow him in corruption, to be raised in corruption. An avenging ghost at many a sick bedside. At nightfall, a shadowy figure comes to the iron gate. It stands looking through the bars for a little while, then, with an old broom it carries, it softly sweeps the step.
It was very good to me, was it?
How do you do, Mr. Tulkinghorn?
How do you do, Sir Leicester? Your ladyship.
Mr. Tulkinghorn.
I'd heard you'd returned from Paris, so I thought I'd come here to Chesney Wold to report to you. I've been much engaged in the several suits between yourself and Boythorn.
An extremely dangerous person. A low character.
He is obstinate. The only question is, will you give up anything? Any minor point?
Mr. Tulkinghorn, there can be no minor points between myself and Boythorn. He's an ill-conditioned, leveling person. 50 years ago, he'd probably been tried at the Old Bailey for some demagogic proceeding and severely punished. If not hanged, drawn and quartered.
Very well, Sylvester. Now I have my instructions. I have some news for her ladyship.
For me?
The person whose writing you inquired about.
Oh, yes. I can't imagine what association I had with a hand like that. But I surely had some.
You had some?
Yes, I think I must have had some. Did you really take the trouble to find out the writer of that, was it, affidavit?
I did.
How very odd. So, did you find him?
I found him. I found him dead.
Oh, Jeremy.
I was directed to his lodging, a miserable place, and I found him dead.
Excuse me, Mr. Tulkinghorn, but I think the least said...
Pray, let us hear the story out.
Whether he died by his own hand...
Really, I must...
Let him finish.
If you wish it, my dear, but I must say...
No, you mustn't. Go on, Mr. Tulkinghorn.
I was about to say that I couldn't tell you whether he died by his own hand, but he certainly died by his own act. The coroner's jury thought he took the poison accidentally.
Poison?
Opium.
What kind of man was this deplorable creature?
Difficult to say. He'd lived wretchedly and was very neglected. But there was a notion abroad that he'd once been something better.
What did they call the wretched being?
Nemo. That's what he called himself. No one knew his real name. And there were no papers to tell us.
Well, certainly a collection of horrors, but they interest one for the moment. Mr. Tulkinghorn, have the goodness to open the door.
During the utterance of every word of this short dialogue, Lady Dedlock and Mr. Tulkinghorn, without any other alteration in their customary deportment, have looked very steadily at one another. Now, with her usual insolent grace, she passes through the door he holds deferentially open for her. How much, perhaps, each would give to know what is hidden in the other's heart. The days pass, and her ladyship becomes restless, very restless. Sir Leicester takes to his bed with the gout, a family ailment, and there is little, it seems, to interest her at Chesney Wold. She flits away to town again. What connection can there be between the place in Lincolnshire, the house in town, and the whereabouts of Joe, the outlaw with the broom, who sweeps his crossing all day long, unconscious of the link, if any link there be? Joe lives, that is to say, Joe has not yet died, in a ruinous place by the name of Tom Allalone's, whose tumbling tenements contain by night a swarm of misery. Twice lately there has been a crash and a cloud of dust like the springing of a mine in Tom Allalone's, and each time a house has fallen, the gaps remain, and as several more houses are nearly ready to go, the next crash in Tom Allalone's may be expected to be a good one. This desirable property is in Chancery, of course. The day is turning to a dark and drizzly evening. Joe sweeps his crossing among the mud and wheels and gets but a scanty sum to pay for his wretched lodging. But as he looks up, he sees that a woman is beckoning to him. She is in black and veiled. Her dress is that of an upper servant, but her step, her manner, suggest something different.
Boy.
Yes?
Are you the boy I read about in the papers?
I don't know about the papers.
Were you examined at an inquest?
Don't know nothing about... Where I was took by the beadle, do you mean? Was the boy's name Joe?
Yes.
That's me. You mean about the man?
Speak lower. Did he look? Did he look very ill and poor?
Did he just?
Did he look like you?
Oh, no, not so bad as me. You didn't know him, did you?
How dare you ask me if I knew him?
No offence, m'lady.
I'm not a lady. I'm a servant.
You're a jolly servant.
Listen and be silent. Stand further from me. Can you show me all those places that were spoken of in the account I read? the place he wrote for, the place he died at, and the place where he was buried. Do you know the place where he was buried?
Yes, I does.
Go before me and show me all those dreadful places. Stop opposite to each and don't speak to me unless I speak to you. Don't look back. Do what I want, and I will give you more money than you've ever had in your life.
Joe puts his broom under his arm and leads the way, passing deftly with his bare feet over the hard stones and through the mud and mire. Cook's Court.
Who lives here? Him what give him his writing and give me half a crown.
Go on to the next.
On to Crook's house. Joe stops.
Who lives here?
He lived here.
In which room?
In the back room, up there. You can see the window from this corner. Up there. That's where I've seen him stretched out.
Go on to the next. To where he is buried.
He was put there.
Oh, what a horrible place. Where?
Over yonder, among them pile of bones. They put them in very nigh the top. I was obliged to stamp on the coffin to get it in. The gate's locked. I can't show you any nearer.
Look at that rat! Oh, there it goes. It's the ground.
Is this place of abomination consecrated ground?
I don't know nothing of consequential ground.
Is it blessed?
Blessed if I know. Blessed? I should think it was covered myself.
Here's your payment. Now, show me the place again.
It's over there, see? Where am I pointing with my broom? What's this? She's gone.
But the coin she gave him is still there. It glints yellow. The first piece of gold he's seen in his whole life. Joe bites it, puts it away for safety, and sweeps the step with great care before he slinks off into the growing dusk. Come, night. Come, darkness. For you cannot come too soon or stay too long by such a place as this.
In part two of Charles Dickens's Bleak House, dramatized in 8 episodes by Betty Davis, the part of Esther Summerson was played by Brenda Blessing and Mr. Jarndyce by Michael Bryant. Richard Carsten, Andrew Sear, Ada, Maggie Wilkinson, Harold Stimpole, David Collings, Mr. Boythorn, Leslie Sands, Mr. Guppy, William Nye, Mr. Kenge, Philip Voss, Lady Dedlock, Sarah Kestelman, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Jack May, Mr. Tulkinghorn, Robert Lang, Joe, Danny Webb, Miss Flight, Sylvia Coleridge, Crook, John Hollis, Gridley, John Livesey, Alan Woodcourt, Adam Barham, Mr. Snagsby, Hugh Dixon, Charlie, Angela Pleasance, Tom, Toby Hales, Jenny, Teresa Stretfield, and her husband, Michael McStay, Mrs. Pardiggle, Di Langford, Mrs. Blinder, Rosalind Adams, and the coroner, Stephen Thorne, with Simon Cadell as Charles Dickens. The director was Jane Morgan.